This is a conversation with writer and organizer Joy Ayoub on the August 4th explosion in Beirut's port that has decimated the city and sent shockwaves out that will affect the country politically, economically, and spiritually for generations to come. The blast in terms of scope and scale was apocalyptic. And what I talked to Joey about today is what it's like to continue living and moving forward the day after the apocalypse. Many in Lebanon were already fatigued by a ruling elite that refuses to give up power, as well as a government that sees its citizens as subjects to be exploited rather than as stakeholders in a cooperative society. To couple this with an explosion that has decimated the cultural and economic heart of Lebanon seems almost too much to bear, but bear it, Lebanon will. And how to face the apocalypse and realize you have to keep on living is much of what Joey and I talk about today, as well as the great anger we share for the ruling elite of Lebanon and the global ruling class who allows these thieves, murderers, and evil men to dare to call themselves leaders in a country they exploit as brutally as they do in Lebanon. For more conversations like this, you can go to our back catalog, The Arts of Travel. We have great podcasts and conversations with the same amount of honesty and urgent moral intensity as the one I have with Joey today. You can also go to our main website, asiaarttours.com, for print interviews and programs. We have a wonderful conversation up with the academic Jody Malamed, as well as numerous print interviews about the Black Lives Matter protests and global protests throughout Asia. And for more with Joey Ayoub, you can go to his own website. He hosts a podcast and does writing for numerous outlets globally. His podcast is called The Fire These Times, and he's a frequent contributor on Mongol Media. All right, here's my conversation now with Joey on facing the unfaceable and what Lebanon does next after this tragedy. Thank you.
My name is Joey Ayoub. I'm a writer originally from Lebanon and currently based in Switzerland for my studies.
This event obviously has been really traumatic, and we'll talk about it in sort of a podcasty news sort of way, but has it affected you artistically at all? Are you doing anything different? When we had talked before, I know writing for a lot of people generally has been a challenge with COVID, but has this provoked a reaction from you that sort of unexpected?
Yeah, well, I haven't written anything, so that's one thing. I'm still trying to finish this piece that I spoke about on the Mangan Media podcast, because it's for them, so I'm writing it for Mangan Media. I haven't managed. Hopefully by this week I'm gonna try and finish it, but besides that, yeah, I haven't managed to do anything really, other than immediate stuff, so like immediate fundraising, donated parts of my salary, just getting some attention sent towards like my mother, because she's a stained glass artist who lost a bunch of her work. So I got her a number of interviews to talk about this, and putting a lot of people in touch with one another. A lot of the interviews that people are seeing, I usually put them in touch with journalists, because I tend not to want to talk to the journalists directly. Not that I have anything personal against it, but I just wouldn't be in that kind of state of mind. And I would prefer just talking to either podcasters or like small blogs and small websites and that kind of thing, rather than the big names they tend to have like, you know, more resources at hand. So like artistically, it's just been that I don't know, this is probably very, very quaint and pointless detail, but I got a PS4, which I haven't had a video console since I was like, I don't know, like my last one was a PS2. So like, I don't know what, 10 years now or more than that. I still have PS1 games that I used to play back home because I'm very bad with change. That's how pathetically bad with change I am. But yeah, I got one to sort of force myself to be distracted. That's the best way to put it. It's the only thing I found that forces me to be present in the moment, so to speak. I need to finish this mission. I need to do this. I need to do that. I can do two things at once. If I'm watching a movie and I'm in a bad state of mind, I would just pause the movie and then check the internet, you know, that kind of thing, which is why I miss cinemas. That's the same for the same reason, because then you're forced in a space where I'm too self-conscious to use my phone. So I would just shut up and watch the movie. So it's been that, really. It's been a daily daily effort or struggle to just maintain some modicum of sanity, some functionality, something that doesn't just lead me to collapse, because, collapse isn't very good, is it?
Globally, I think, like, these notions we have of apocalypse are probably not what it actually looks like. I think it probably looks like Beirut, where something just happens randomly somewhere that no one sees coming, and it just completely destroys any vestige of what was. And on, like, these, like, individual levels of, like, probably every day on this planet, people experience their own apocalypse. So you probably saw from the questions we'll get into, that's a lot of what I'm thinking about, of, like, if Lebanon is a preview of the future, not trying to frame it as something random, but as something that we're all going to have to face. And it's really important to dialogue with people in that moment of, like, complete rupture, to sort of see and prepare yourself for what's coming for you. Obviously, for Beirut, it's something that it's not any of those things. It's just sort of a numb rage. So for people who don't know, like my dad, who can tell me everything about Nagorno-Karabakh, but when it comes to leaving that small part of the world in terms of foreign policy, doesn't know too much. For the scope and scale, what has the damage been like? What has been sort of the final accounting, if we've arrived at that?
We haven't arrived to the final accounting, and we'll talk about this. Well, I'll just talk about it in this answer as well, because it's part of the problem in Lebanon. We never actually have a final tally. We won't know how many people fully died, like the full number of how many people died, because we don't do these kinds of things. We don't have statistics. We don't have census even. We don't even know how many people live in Lebanon, because the government doesn't do census. In terms of the scale, so it happened on the 1st of August, 2020, 4th of August, sorry, 2020. Tomorrow it will be 3 weeks since that happened. It happened at exactly 6 or 8 p.m. It lasted roughly like 10 seconds or so. There were two blasts. The big one is the second one that that everyone saw, the sort of like mushroom cloud effect. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, it's the third or fourth worst non-nuclear explosion in history. And that was because there were some 2,700-something tons of ammonium nitrate that were just sitting there in hangar 12, I believe, at the port of Beirut. And in that same hangar, you had stuff like fireworks, possibly weapons, but we're not sure. Lots of hazardous materials, that's for sure. And that undoubtedly made the explosion even worse. And so as of now, I think the numbers of dead are over 220. They could go up. This does not include everyone who would die from injuries that sustained during the blast. And that's in the thousands of people who were injured during the blast. It will not include people who might die because, their social insurance just got worse because they don't have a home anymore and that kind of thing. It's sort of like I've compared it to the COVID-19 numbers. Like, you have the numbers of people who died from COVID-19, but you don't include people who died from cancer because they couldn't get the treatment they needed because the hospital beds were all taken, if you see what I mean. So kind of like the secondary waves of injured and death, essentially. Those will not be included in the numbers because it would definitely be at least in the several hundreds, if not more than that. Roughly half of Beirut was heavily impacted because due to the location of where the port is and where the grain silos, where there were a number of grain silos that absorbed part of the impact, you had East Beirut essentially that was more heavily affected than West Beirut. And here I'm using Civil War terms when the city was actually divided. East Beirut being some of the popular neighborhoods like Jemaisin, Ma'am Khayil, and all of the areas around Karantina, Bush Hamoud, all of those places, those were more heavily impacted because they literally overlook the port. Like, there's nothing, the port of Beirut, there's nothing between them other than one road, and then you just have these neighborhoods. So you have all of sort of like kind of iconic cafes, restaurants, bars, small shops, a small dekan where they, sell manaish. And it was kind of, Jemaisa was the last, Jemaisa and Mam Khalil, but especially Jemaisa, have this reputation for being kind of iconic. Like, the buildings are old. People just have the same businesses they've had since the 50s and 60s, many of whom, survived the Civil War, that kind of thing. And there was a particular very bitter aftertaste, in addition to the shock and horror of this, that it particularly hit this part that was so youthful. And the fact that the youth in Lebanon, at least so the story goes, are seeking to leave and all leave Lebanon, find a second passport, try and find jobs abroad, all of these things. And that Jemaise is sort of blowing up like this, it's sort of like, symbolically, Lebanon is telling you leave already. That's how it feels like. And so when you mix that with COVID-19, reduced mobility around the world, and the economic crisis, meaning people can't even afford to buy tickets, let alone afford to get a visa, let alone Western governments, for example, or Gulf governments giving them visa in the first place, it's sort of just accentuated and aggravated all of those pre-existing fault lines within Lebanese society, if you want. And here by Lebanese society, I just mean society in Lebanon. I don't just mean people who have the nationality that have just been exposed in some ways for what they are, with the added insult over injury, although I really feel that this expression is inadequate, side of things, which is that, like, you can't do anything about, like, you, as I said, you can't leave, you can't just pick up arms and shoot these guys. You can't really do anything. So you're kind of stuck with sitting there in the waste, in the after waste, in the post-apocalyptic nightmare that we saw as these scenes in Beirut. You're just stuck sitting there. This is the day after the apocalypse, essentially. And now we've had almost 3 weeks of it.
So what have been the ways people are talking about life in Beirut right now? What are some of the metaphors or words or feelings or phrases that are being shared or you've come into contact with over and over and over?
Well, like, the most optimistic thing I've seen is to compare it to Chernobyl, because Chernobyl ended, or supposedly was like the seed that took down the Soviet Union five, what was it, 4 or 5 years later. That's like the most optimistic take, is that you hope that this is so bad that at least these guys won't be able to stay anymore. This is just not possible. But as Lena Munzer said on my own podcast just a few days after the blast, she really doesn't think that these people will be held accountable. And I think most people don't actually believe that any of those guys will be held accountable, because, like, why would they? There's no one else. There's no, you don't have this, you don't have an independent judiciary. You don't have, and if you do, like, it doesn't have any power really. They have the army on their side. They have all of the militias. They are the militias. The militias are the government. So, like, what kind of accountability can people expect? The only thing that people were hoping for was a kind of like an international investigation thing. But for that to happen, the Lebanese government would have to officially approve it. And they won't do it because they are the ones implicated by it. It's like asking the criminals to be the judges, really. It doesn't happen. So on the streets, so to speak, and I can say that, I mean, I say this from Geneva. So, I speak to lots of people, I see their reactions online. It's just friends and family, really. My sister's in-laws, their apartment was blown away. They were hospitalized for like several days. Thankfully, they're okay now. My mother's stained glass workshop was destroyed. Something like 20 or 21 of her projects, which are mainly churches in around Beirut, as well as a couple of museums, including some of the iconic ones that people have been sharing. Those are all completely gone. Pretty much everything that I know, essentially, of like my memories in Gymnase and Mount Royal, which, as I mentioned before, is very like youth oriented. A lot of students are there. A lot of like service workers are there. It's sort of like one of those neighborhoods. Those are completely gone. Completely gone. A lot of the cafes and buildings and so on, are in like structurally unsound buildings, and so they will have to be taken down. In terms of what people are saying, I'm seeing just everything related to PTSD, really. Lots of people struggling to sleep, those who were near the explosion, especially any sound of like loud noises is scaring the shit out of them. Very classic PTSD symptoms. Lina Munzer, again, she mentioned how she thought of those very cheesy American Vietnam War movies where like the soldiers come back from the war and have all of these nightmares. And she mentioned something along the lines of like, what they don't say is how numb you actually feel at the end of it. It's not just that loud noises scare you, although that's the case with some people. It's also just that you don't know what to do, really. That's the numbness of it, like numb rage, as you called it. Like that's really the main emotion. And the few days after the explosion, you had lots of rage, people having these gallows and hanging nooses and that kind of thing. We have this expression in Arabic called like fashit khla, like it's just you kind of like to get it out, really, to let it all out, kind of like screaming in a pillow sort of thing, but you do it on the streets. And that was soon replaced by more helplessness, really, because again, we were already dealing with COVID-19 and economic collapse. Most people's savings are gone. People, especially those, young folks in their 20s and early 30s, this is supposedly their moment or whatever, that's gone, really. I don't think anyone's really in denial about it. So there's just this aftermath, the realization of what was lost. That is very difficult to swallow. It's something that, like, you can accept it, but even if you do accept it, it's not like you have anything. Like, as I said, with the zombie movies, at least you can kill some zombies, here there's nothing to do. There's no one to kill. I mean, sure, there's the warlords and the people in power, but as I said, they have the guns. So there isn't much that people can do in terms of immediate change. And so they're desperately looking in some ways to do anything else that can be done, which at this point is just a coping mechanism.
One of the questions I wanted to ask you is, Ruth Wilson Gilmore and Lina Munzer have both talked about this phenomenon called organized abandonment. I don't think Lina used that term, but it's very much fits her piece, where she talks about in Beirut, basically you drown in your own shit, because decades of infrastructure has been corrupted by graft or subcontracting or just grifting off the projects, and there's no proper sewage infrastructure. But for when we look at sort of Beirut, I guess the question I'd want to ask for Lebanon's elites is, rather than saying this was a tragedy, this was an accident, do people see it as sort of deliberate because Beirut infrastructure or Beirut governance has long sort of been this philosophy of organizing what we're going to sacrifice, organizing what we're going to cast off? And if so, what did they do with what they sort of let to rot? With what they let to rot, where did those riches go and what do those riches look like? So right now, all of Beirut is affected, but have the elites still found a way to shield themselves physically? It sounds like politically they have. So if we have these two Beiruts, one that's organized abandonment, what does the Beirut look like where it's organized, sort of where we take the loot after we siphon it off of infrastructure for sewage, infrastructure for proper port security? What does that look like? And do you see that as sort of what's happened here, where this was not an accident, this was very deliberate?
So what they siphon it off, it's outside of Lebanon usually. They do have some projects in around Lebanon. Usually it's like mansions and lots of residential properties that they own, but for the most part they just take the money and leave really, or they put their money abroad. So we have like an estimated billions of dollars. We don't have an exact number, obviously, of pretty much like Lebanese taxpayers' dollars sitting in like, the some Caribbean islands or like in some Swiss bank account or whatever, that kind of thing. This is not new. All of the prime ministers since the Civil War ended have been billionaires, I think actually without any exception. And in addition to that, they spent billions of dollars as like, taxpayers' money. For their travel expenses and lifestyle and that kind of thing. And it's not just prime ministers, foreign ministers did that, presidents do that. Speakers of parliament, there's only one, Nabih Berri, he's done that. I mean, we don't really know how much he has, but like he is estimated to have quite a lot of money. It's both extremely well known and invisibilized, like we don't actually know how much these people have because they don't tell you. You don't have these transparency laws or anything like that. Or if you do, they're not really applied. In terms of whether this is deliberate or not, yes and no. It's deliberate in the sense that they knew that the explosives were there. And so there is some element of responsibility, like a big element of responsibility that goes there because the president and the prime minister, well, now acting prime minister, they were both informed just like a few weeks before the explosion happened. Hassan Nasrallah, leader of Hezbollah, he gave a speech a few days later saying that he knows nothing about the port of Beirut, which is like really a ridiculous thing to say, and no one actually believes these things because Hezbollah has its hands on all of the security services in Lebanon. That's not really a secret. You see them yourself when you go there. They don't exactly hide it. Nabih Berri said the same thing. The president, Michel Aoun, said the same thing. He said, like, I think it was like 2 or 3 days later, he said something like, "Ana makhasne," which is just this expression means like, it's none of my problem. Like, it's just not me. I didn't do anything. It's not my fault, kind of thing. As for the term organized abandonment, it really feels to me more like it applies to the international setting of Lebanon. Lebanon has been sort of this middle ground in many conflicts. Not that I don't want to push this narrative too much because it can be taken to another extreme and remove agency from the warlords who have made it that way, for example. But it is true that, for example, when the Civil War ended in 1990, it ended because Lebanon was sort of just sacrificed, geopolitically speaking. The Americans wanted the Syrians on their side in the first Gulf War, and they did. And kind of like Lebanon was sort of the prize because Lebanon mattered quite a lot to Syria, the Syrian government anyway, the Assad regime government, historically speaking. And so it was more of a managed chaos and managed that's what sectarianism is. It's managed chaos. It's something that it doesn't work. It doesn't actually work in as much as like it provides any kind of services. It doesn't even provide good services in the sense like, the Shia leaders provide good services to the Shia people. It doesn't even do that. It just provides the absolute bare minimum in the form of like, you might have an insurance issue and you can't afford hospitals, so you go to your local Zaim. And Zaim just means like local chieftain or whatever. And you tell him, it's always a him, of course. Listen, I can't do this. Can you do this for me, please? My cousin fought for you in the south of Lebanon, or my cousin f fought for you in Syria. And so it's that kind of thing. And I'm talking about Hezbollah as an example, but it really works across the sectarian parties. What changes really is just how efficient they are in the moment and how not. Some others are not, for example. But organized abandonment just feels global when it comes to Lebanon. Lebanon only has two borders, land borders, Syria and Israel. Obviously, not exactly the easiest two neighbors to have. The other border is the sea, and the sea is then further limited, if you want, by the fact that the closest one is Cyprus, and so you have the EU origin immediately, the Schengen area. And then Greece and Italy, all of those things are inaccessible to the Lebanese without a visa. And you have Turkey. Sure, Turkey is a bit to the north, but it's not easy to get there either, or at least not easy to stay there. And so the global ab organized abandonment, just it really does feel sometimes that you just have these spots on the planet that are like sacrifice zones for capitalism, sacrifice zones for like the so-called organization of nation states, where they don't have the same value as human beings. And I feel like if not, like if most people can't put it in the terms that I put it to you now, which I'm only able to do because I've studied it in some ways, they will still say it in different words, like in different ways. Like you would still have sort of like expressions like, nothing matters, and where is the government is the common expression in Lebanon, like common question. Say, when a dawla, like where is the government? And the thing is that where the government is. You ask that question rhetorically in some ways. What you mean by it is like, where are these services that we are supposed to get? That's what it means in the end. So yeah, I mean, Lina's piece on waste is very emblematic of what happened. She published it not too long before the actual explosion, and it goes into the details of what it means to live, like what is the political system in Lebanon. For me, it is best symbolized by waste. Like that is really what it is. Everything is wasted, and in some ways you feel like people are wasted as well. The potential is wasted as well, and of the potential of people is wasted because they're too busy coping really with the aftermath. And it is extremely important, I'll just emphasize on this as a final note on this question. It's extremely important to highlight the fact that we live in a post-war era run by the warlords of the war. Like that is not a small detail in the story. That is the entirety of the story, actually. That's like 80% of the story. If these people were not there, we would not be dealing with the same problems right now. And that's just a fact. And it's such an obvious and overwhelming fact that it's actually easy not to think about it. It's easier to kind of hope that you can just do some changes at like the lower levels, for example, fix the get a better guy as prime minister, or one person change that person. Maybe that would make some difference. But the entire structure of post-war Lebanon is built by the warlords. And so it is built to benefit them. That is obviously how it is. And they don't need to be particularly conscious about it. They don't need to do it actively. It serves them anyway, whether they do so actively or not. And that's a very important point to focus on.
I think increasingly, like where we live is not is will be indifferent to the lives of its citizens in more and more explicit ways. So when I think of the sort of port tragedy, another great parallel would be like Flint, where Flint was just literally left, like they're like, oh, it's slightly cheaper to poison all these people and it will enrich, the various privatized contracts that Michigan allowed to seep into their governance. So they just did that. When we look at things like the logic of the Amazon under Bolsonaro, or even COVID, like the how COVID was may have been released or likely was released was through increasing incursions into nature that are sort of metaphoric of the larger self-destruction that capitalism unleashes on the world. So to like go back to something like a Hong Kong or a Lebanon, I just sort of see them as warnings from the future. Like I don't think any of us, like states, increasingly are going to matter except for a shrinking few. But I don't know, is that something that you feel as someone who's more global? Or are you still hopeful for things like socialism? Or I say that because I don't fucking know what people even are hoping for anymore.
The kilon yani kilon expression that we've had in Lebanon, which is just like all of them means all of them, it's been like you can sort of have a globalized version of that. It means that like none of these people should be tolerated anymore. And I feel like this is sort of happening. I can't really speak to what people are hoping for in Lebanon necessarily. You just have a lot of confusing statements, and they change a lot, and people don't know what they want because like it doesn't matter. That's really the the end goal here is that even if you want this, even if you did want like a welfare state or whatnot, it doesn't mean that you'll get it. It doesn't mean that we even have the money to do it, you know. So right now we have a situation where we're just unable to see what's next, really. And so the thing with like Lebanon being a warning from the future is that it's always been that. That's the thing, is that it's just that people were not paying attention to Lebanon because it's just too small. It doesn't really matter geopolitically except when shit hits the fan between Israel and Hezbollah, really. I think our politicians are sometimes aware of this, like, you know, when ex-foreign minister Gibran Basile says things like, if you don't save us, if you don't help Lebanon, you will have a refugee crisis on your shores, you being Fortress Europe here, because referring to the Syrian refugees that are in Lebanon that are used as this like as this threat, essentially. And because he knows that it works, and he knows that in some ways, like, these people are just the most honest versions of what the nation states are to me. Gibran Basile understands very well that the EU only cares about people not coming to the EU, you know, or the wrong kind of people not coming to the EU, meaning black and brown people. Everyone knows this by now, you know, like, it would be quite ludicrous to expect me, for example, to say that I think the EU is racist, and to have a number of Europeans telling me, no, it's not. I mean, it does happen for sure. But it feels that it is increasingly ridiculous as an argument, and that people are actually much more comfortable just saying, yeah, it is, and it needs to be, because, well, we cannot accept everyone, you know, that kind of argument. And I feel like people are, or many people anyway, are much more comfortable now sitting with that narrative, whereas before they would at least pay lip service to political correctness and this kind of universal idea and that kind of thing. So in Lebanon, we don't really have much time to adopt a Killon mentality or like narrative towards everyone, because no one is giving us anything anyway. It's not like you have on one side Emmanuel Macron, who had this like publicized meet, you know, visit to Lebanon the next day. It's not like he said, so for those who don't know, he said that he'll come back in early September with this plan or this proposal to the Lebanese government. That will be dependent on them getting the money that they were supposed to get, or they were promised to get anyway, if they implement a number of reforms. It doesn't seem like it's going to make any difference. That's the thing, is that the rest of it is people debating, oh, well, are these reforms good? Are these reforms bad? We've gotten to the point in Lebanon where the IMF looks good in comparison to the Lebanese government. Like, that's how low the standards are. That's what I really need to emphasize, is that we're not talking about a situation where we really feel that what we do, what we say makes any difference. So we're just looking for any kind of immediate relief, just to give us enough time to think about these big pictures. And for me, that is a message from the future. For me, this is what people don't understand. And this is why these apocalyptic movies are so misleading. And it's like, you know, if you watch Avengers, then you have this guy who wants to kill half of the planet or the universe. All you need to do is beat the shit out of the guy. And that resolves it. There's nothing to beat up here. There's no one to defeat. There's no one person anyway to defeat. It's diffused. It's decentralized. We're talking about the CEOs of the world and the oil magnates and the warlords and the mafiosos and the governments and the leaders of governments and et cetera, et cetera. We no longer have a dozen heads of state as it was the case during the empires that you can focus on. You know, the anarchists would assassinate this empress or this emperor at like 100 years ago. These don't exist anymore. It's not the same kind of struggle. It's not the same kind of problematic, if you see what I mean. And I feel like this is where we're at. And this is the example of Lebanon. You know, Belarusians now are rising up against Lukashenko. And that's very important. And they genuinely feel, and, you know, good on them, that they need to get rid of him. In Lebanon, there's no one person to get rid of. Like, you can get rid of Michel Aoun, but Nabih Berri is still there. You can get rid of Nabih Berri, but Hassan Nasrallah is still there. And then you have Samir Jarjah, and then you have Saad al-Hariri, and then you have Walid Jumblat, and then you have a dozen other names. And these people have all agreed on this power-sharing agreement. They have found it more efficient. than just struggling for power, for ultimate power. They have willingly given up power. That's what people need to understand. Hezbollah willingly gives up a part of its power to Amal and the Free Patriotic Movement, its allies, because it knows that if it has all of the cards, then it will become more vulnerable. So it willingly chooses to have fewer cards with the condition that these other people follow more or less, or at least roughly speaking, the same line of politics. And that's been a much more efficient model because now you can't go after any one person. They sort of adopted the same tactics that we said are good for us, like as protesters. If we're decentralized, they cannot take out our leaders. They've done this, but with the actual leaders, like with the actual people in government.
But do you see that as, when we say a warning from the future, do you see that as, let's look at, let's say, any mayor in a U.S. city where the response to protest has been pretty brutal? Hong Kong, pretty brutal. Pretty much anywhere, if you bring up protest, Greece, pretty brutal. Australia, pretty brutal. Is it something where, my point is more that, like, everything within these models is lost, that there's not going to be, let's say, a great electoral wave, or if we replace the politicians of Lebanon or Hong Kong or China, that things can change, and that until we abandon the vocabulary, like that we keep using the vocabulary of the past as the future continues to melt because we haven't figured out a new vocabulary to sort of talk about the problems we're facing. And I'm wondering, for like this idea of kill on Yanni kill on, does it acknowledge that when we wipe everything away, that we would be building something new? Or is it still within the idea of, like you were saying, well, we'll get the IMF, we'll try to get socialists? Or is it something where we would even wipe away like what Lebanon is? Because Lebanon has always had this sort of contested meaning, very contested history of what it is. Do you see in Kill on Yanni Kill on sort of like a negative space, like a void where something new could be built?
Yeah, I do. I do. I think Kill on Yanni Kill on is just this shield in some ways. And it might sound odd to think of it this way, but I'll try and explain myself because it's a bit vague in my mind. But basically, it doesn't look good to be a CEO in Lebanon. It doesn't look good to be a warlord in Lebanon. It doesn't look good to be head of state in Lebanon. All of these institutions are poisoned as far as the general public goes. So that leaves open, if you're on the potential, the possibilities of what to do in that void, if you see what I mean. But at the same time, we're also just painfully aware that there is no such thing as a quick apocalypse, as we mentioned. And if we're talking about a slow apocalypse, what we're actually debating essentially is, well, what do we do when we land in that apocalypse? And how can we make that apocalypse slightly less toxic? Apocalypses are not all equal, essentially. You have an apocalypse where the main thing you're worried about is cholera, and you have an apocalypse where the main thing that you're worried about is nuclear waste. You know, those are not the same thing. And one can be dealt with in a certain way. The other will take decades, if not hundreds of years, and essentially, which is impossible for modern human society to deal with. So you have some stuff that are like extinction level apocalypses, and you have other stuff that are more like, shit is gonna be bad for a long time. And no one is really, we're not really debating whether, just to use the metaphor of the apocalypse again, we're not really debating whether the apocalypse is here or not. Everyone is just, yeah, it is. Like, you know, that's it. Like, you know, khalas, we're not even having these debates and these discussions. The debates and discussions are like, how do we get rid of the people preventing us from doing anything about it? It's very, very concrete. It's very pragmatic in some ways. You might even say cynical, because we're not thinking of grand narratives anymore. You don't have these debates as, like, for the most part, you don't have that many debates as to like whether you should have universal healthcare or you should have universal education. You know, most people, if you ask them, they will probably say that they agree with this. These are popular demands in Lebanon, but it's just not part of the cards on the table because the money isn't there anymore. Those systems are designed to exist through the taxpayer system. You have a certain amount put into a certain fund that then goes into universal education and then goes or into, you know, universal healthcare. Same for like housing and all of those systems. The money isn't there. The money was stolen. The money's gone. There isn't enough dollars in the country, which that's how it works. That's how the global system works. To have these services. So what you have is smaller scale stuff. You have, you know, churches and mosques and volunteers and doctors working overtime and, you know, that kind of thing. That's what's been sustaining the system, which we can just describe it as some form of mutual aid. The question is how to make that, how to scale that up. That's the main question for me. It's a pragmatic question, is how do you scale up the thing that we know is working? The aftermath, I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen in 5 years. I don't know the effects of global warming that it can have on a small place like Lebanon. We know that the entire region is at risk of desertification. We know that the rich Gulf countries and Egypt and Israel, of course, are the ones being really focused on by the so-called international community, because that's where the capital is. And we know that Lebanon isn't. Like, it is not inconceivable that Lebanon stops existing in the near future. That's the thing. And I'm not saying stops existing in the sense that we join some kind of better federation or whatever. No, I just mean that really it just stops existing and it becomes a wasteland and becomes this place where we know people live. We know that they vaguely define themselves as Lebanese or whatnot, but their passport is no good. They can't go anywhere because the borders are closed and they're just left there to rot. And like people who think that this is impossible, I don't think they're just paying attention to many places around the world today. We got used to these numbers, you know, we got used to saying stuff like one in whatever child in Africa suffers from this or that. But what does that actually mean? In practice, it means that entire ecosystem or social ecosystems are gone. They're not functioning. And so they just rely on international aid to not starve to death. And many of them still do starve to death. That's the sort of scenario that has been essentially imposed through global, what's that word that we use, global organized abandonment. That's what it is. But it's not the organized bit, it's what's important, is that this is a choice. This is a choice by those who have more power. And this is a choice by everyone else who's not really seeing it as for what it is. That's how I view it anyway. I mean, other people can probably disagree with that, but that's how I view it.
And so Lushenko is pretty interesting in this moment, in this conversation, because he literally says the things that I think dictators think. So he literally will get on TV and say, if you want me out, kill me. Other than that, fuck you. And it wipes away all the niceties and the... I interviewed Long T. Bway, who I really love, about necropolitics in U.S. universities. And he said of Trump, like, Trump, the reason he makes elites so mad is he just doesn't try. There's none of the pomp, none of the bells and whistles and statescraft. It's just, no, I'm going to take your shit. If you're poor, go fuck yourself. And Lushenko is very much the same way. For people who are committed to nonviolence, or no one wants to be a thug to do these things, is there a sense of anything that these people actually care about? I know certain buildings were targeted immediately after the explosion, but is there a sense from your scholarship of Lebanese sort of activism or protest, and what you've observed maybe with Belarus, the failure of peace to work in Hong Kong, the failure of peace to work in the U.S., to be frank, for they've just shot someone in the back 3 times today. And this has been going on now for 3 months. Do you have any sense of, should we all just prepare to die and we all need to start organizing along those lines? Or what have your thoughts been in this this moment of great rage at how nothing seems to get through from people being kind and peaceful and nonviolent in our protests?
Yeah, in Lebanon, so I'll focus on the case in Lebanon. There's, in the immediate aftermath, as we mentioned before, there's been like increasing rage, and you had these symbolic, you know, hangman's nooses in Martyr Square. What was extraordinary to them, and you know, many people have focused on this for their own different reasons, but I feel either, you know, they do so cynically or they are just missing the point. You had Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, who was among them, and this is something that usually you don't see. Usually, you see just like in the chance, right? Like you would have Killon Yani Killon, and then you might have someone added, like, you know, and Michelin is one of them and whatnot. Usually, if you did like a statistical analysis, you would see that the name that is mentioned the least is Hassan Nasrallah. And that is because people are just afraid of him. It's really that simple. And also because there is a religious element to it, added to it, because he is a Sayyid, he is a Shia cleric. And the fact that we had his portrait hanged in the same way as the others really shows that we got to a point where people are actually willing to target religion now. That is something that is not easy to talk about in Lebanon at all. And by religion, I don't mean people's individual beliefs and whatnot. And I hope people don't get me wrong. I really don't care about these things. People can believe in whatever they want to believe in. It's more like the organized powers that draw their capital, essentially, their social, cultural, symbolic, even financial capital from the religion, from the fact that they are, like Hassan Nasrallah, if he was not a Sayyid, he would not be where he is, for example. It's not just that he's a brilliant military mind or whatnot. He has military people around him as well. It is the fact that he is a religious figure. That is what's important here. And the same goes to some of the others as well. Like other religious figures in Lebanon also have power, but not really to the same extent. Anyway, I'm rambling a bit. But the point is that should we all prepare ourselves to die? No, like, I mean, I know that it was more of a rhetorical question, but I think that we got to the point where people are just painfully aware that it is either us or them. And the shitty thing, really, is not even that. Like, that's what's incredible about it, is that if it was just either us or them, like, if we really knew for a fact that all we need to do is shoot the guys, and the next day things will be better, then this might have already happened by now. I mean, they do have their security. I just don't know if their security is that good. No one is that good other than Hezbollah in Lebanon. I mean, going after Nasrallah would be impossible. But the others, their security isn't that good. It really isn't. It's just that people haven't gone there because it will mean almost certainly that they will, it will be a suicide mission, really. So we're not at the point, if you wanna use that example, we're not at the point, I mean, I may be wrong, but I don't think we're at the point where people really feel like this one guy, let's say, who really feels that he has nothing more to lose, he has lost his family and whatnot. Now it's worth it that if he just sacrifices himself, goes on a suicide mission and kills a warlord down with him. And part of why that would not happen is because power is diffused in Lebanon. Again, if it was a Lukashenko, and you might have different calculations in mind. You tell yourself, well, at least I'll be the guy who brought down the dictator, you know? In Lebanon, you don't have a dictator. You don't have one. You just have like a dozen smaller ones. And together, they have the power of a single dictator, essentially. But we really are at that level. We're at that level where I feel, and you know, this, it's always a bit risky to say these things out loud, but I do feel like there has to be some kind of cost enacted on them. I genuinely believe that they need to feel the pressure, and they will not feel the pressure through just like losing some money here and there. Like the sanctions, if there are any sanctions, these would make absolutely no difference. They're all billionaires anyway. They have enough money stacked off in some Cayman Islands or Caribbean Islands or like Switzerland or whatever, you know, like these things don't really matter. What will matter is if they really feel personally threatened and they leave because of it, because they cannot rule in exile. They have to rule from the country. That's something that's very important to note here. Mm-hmm.
One of the projects I wanted to work on was like a global union of service workers who, if a billionaire ever came into a hotel, they would make their life a living hell. And I sort of feel like obviously these people aren't going to be sanctioned or punished. I think they're connected in ways where we're not going to be able to talk about it on a podcast, but they're connected to global neoliberalism and the way things are. And they know that. Otherwise, they would never have been allowed to become billionaires because they're all very sick, very corrupt, very evil men and have been rewarded for it at a global scale. And have met all the people who also have been rewarded for their sickness and corruption and their evil on a global scale. I'm sure they've been to Davos. I'm sure they've been to Sun Valley. I'm sure they've sipped tea with Warren Buffett and, you know, killed a mine worker with Elon Musk. So The other thing that I think a lot about is this idea of that we all need to adopt the politics of the refugee. That soon, like, Lebanon is a wonderful place in terms of the people you meet, but it is metaphoric, I think, for what the state will become, which is basically just forcing you into a role and providing literally next to nothing, you having to beg for, like, someone in your neighborhood or someone who has a little bit more capital that's connected to the state to come help you, that services will be wiped away, that any sort of vestige of a social contract will be erased and will return to sort of the time of the Leviathan. And you've worked a lot with things like the Kerfala system, looking into that. You're obviously very interested in the politics of migrants, what it means to have no rights, what it means to have no state. Do you think, along with sort of abolition, would this be something you're thinking a lot about more as a leftist in terms of the trauma that Lebanon has undergone and what we'll need to do in terms of working together to change these systems globally? Because for me, at least, Kilan Yani Kilan, okay, you can fuck up Lebanon, they would just leave. Like, those billionaires would just leave. So it all of them means all of them means no. Every place those people go, they have to be shamed. They have to fear for their lives. They have to believe there's a cost to what they do. And I guess in the inverse of the billionaire would be the refugee. And I'm just wondering how you're thinking about this in this particular moment.
I think it shows a lot, in even in the aftermath of the blast, who gets focused on in the media and who does not. Something like a third, I think, or I'm not sure of the exact numbers, but a significant percentage of those who were killed were Syrian workers who were at the port of Beirut. And it's also in the same way that it happened during the actual revolution in October. The first people who died were two Syrian men who just died because there was a fire and in a building, and they just suffocated to death. And for the most part, no one knows their names. No one talks about them. They don't exist because they don't fit the narrative of a Lebanon. They don't fit the narrative of the Lebanese revolution. They don't fit the narrative of even that they have killed us. And so in the port of Beirut, and therefore in the us, they don't fit in that narrative either. You've had some pushback by some Lebanese on some of the aids that people have received, and Syrian refugees get their own aid as well. And you've had some pushback by some of the xenophobic Lebanese against that aid, as if the only people who suffered from the port of Beirut is the Lebanese. And that reflects a vision of Lebanon that has to be imposed, that has to be regularly reinforced. That's what I meant, not imposed. It has to be imposed on these bodies. It has to be imposed on Syrian refugees. It has to be imposed on migrant domestic workers. Their bodies are the recipients. Their bodies are I'm very bad with metaphors, but like, if you're trying to do a potion and you put the potion in something, they are the something. You have to put it somewhere. You have to put this toxicity, this nationalism, this xenophobia, sectarianism does not exist if you do not have an other that is not part of the sectarian body. You have to have migrant domestic workers, and you have to have migrant workers, and you have to have refugees in the society for these other structures, other isms, like sectarianism in this case, and capitalism for that matter, and patriarchy and so on, to function in the first place. Let me focus in on an example so I don't ramble on for too vaguely. But you cannot have sectarianism, which is both a patriarchal and xenophobic framework and philosophy, if you did not have people to throw it at. If you're a Lebanese Christian, you can't always be throwing it at the Lebanese Shia or the Lebanese Sunni or the Lebanese Druze, because there's always a risk of civil war, and then it opens up the entire system. So what you do is you scapegoat the others. You use that same energy, essentially, to throw it at them, because they have nothing to fight against with. They don't have any of the laws are not on their side. They obviously don't have any of the capital, social capital, symbolic, cultural, financial, all of these capitals, they don't have them. And so the reason why I focus on these people is simply because I have benefited from their misery. Like, I know this in my own life. I know that these people are there to benefit me. And here I'm using myself symbolically. I'm no longer in Lebanon, obviously, but I grew up in that system. I grew up in that world. These people are there because there is a demand on the middle class and upper class sides to have them there. And in order for them to do what they have to do to serve that function, they need to be dehumanized, and they need to be racialized, and they need to be sexualized in the case of migrant domestic workers. And their bodies have to be physically, symbolically controlled. This is how it works. And so my frustration with a lot of the Lebanese scene, a lot of Lebanese activism, a lot of Lebanese whatever, is that as long as they focus on the Lebanese only, they are missing like half of the population of Lebanon. Well, not as much, but like something like 30 or 40% of the people who live in Lebanon aren't Lebanese. You have something like 4 million Lebanese citizens, you have something like 1 million refugees, and then you have something like 500,000, although probably fewer now, that are non-Lebanese migrant domestic workers and whatnot. You have quite a lot of them. Give it, I don't know, 20%, 30%, whatever it is. These people without whom Lebanon couldn't have even existed to 2020. We're talking about the economic crisis that started in 2019 or a bit before. It was we had in 2019 instead of like 10 years before because of these people. That's just a fact. That's just an economic fact. And yet we reward that essentially through those practices. And I don't think it's just a matter of, although that's obviously would be a step forward, especially for them, to just like include them in the labor laws and have social protections. I mean, I think this should happen anyway, because the alternative is so much horrible, so much more horrible. But I think it would still be missing the point as to why was it there in the first place. And I think we can talk about global capitalism. We can talk about this global dehumanization of the labor force. And, you know, that's part of the story. That's a big part of the story. But there is also a very Lebanese story here that the Lebanese, for the most part, do not want to acknowledge. They don't want to acknowledge that when we speak of like my mother's cooking and, you know, that kind of thing, what we sometimes mean is actually the maid's cooking. We just don't consider her part of the cooking, if you see what I mean. Like she's mm-hmm. not even the one who has produced this food. We would say this is my mother's cooking and whatever, even though sometimes it's actually the maid who does it. There's a lot of this part. It's not everyone, of course, but there's a lot of this that gets played out on a day-to-day basis that we don't actually see, that all of those gender norms and the reproduction of patriarchal power, it's applied on them first, and then it's applied on the remaining people who live in Lebanon, namely the Lebanese in this case. And sometimes both, you know, I'm not saying necessarily one is better than the other, but it's a big part of the story, I guess is what I'm trying to get at, that we just don't focus on as much. And part of what I'm just trying to do is to just focus on it a bit more. There isn't much I can do on my own, really, but it's just to focus on it a bit more for people to realize that I'm not just talking about it as like, let me give you another example that's better. When I go on some podcasts or I talk to some people and whatnot, they describe my, not always, but sometimes they would describe my interest, let's say, in the kafala system, the sponsorship system in Lebanon that controls the lives of migrant workers and especially migrant domestic workers. Essentially, their legal status is tied to their employer. That's the key thing that people need to know about. They think that I focus on it because, you know, I have this passion to defend the marginalized communities. And like that doesn't really quite cut it. I mean, sure, I have empathy, like that's a good thing to have, but that's not really my point. My point is that we need to shed a light, so to speak, or to give them the mic or to give them the platform, because they are Lebanon. They are the reason why everything else exists. I'm not just saying this metaphorically. I'm not just saying this as, you know, we should all come together and whatever. I'm not just saying this like that. It's not just this kind of vision of the world, if you want. I'm literally saying that we are ignoring the reason for our functional existence. It's that basic. And we're just not in Lebanon. For the most part, we're just not even in revolutionary settings.
Mm-hmm. A book that you might find therapeutic is Christine Sharp's In the Wake. It talks about how the Atlantic slave trade, Christine Sharp frames it, blackness as being the wake, sort of the ripples of the passing of the boat across the ocean as it transports slaves from Africa to the United States, and trying to figure out what blackness means, not as something linear, but as something that sort of ripples out through time from that historic rape and trauma of Africa. And I'd imagine for Lebanon going forward, it will sort of feel like there is no more linearity. You know, you're sort of living unfortunately, forever through the shockwaves of this event until something new can be built. When I talk about refugees, I suppose something that I need to do a better job of is there's a lot of work right now with people who want to sort of build new vocabulary, build new ways of organizing. And something that I think I wonder about is for your understanding of moments like this where there's literally nothing. There's no one you can call. There's no one you can petition. There's no one you can protest. Is there a sense for you, for the work you're going to do in the future, or the work that you think needs to be done? Is it literally just like, okay, let's figure out how can we get someone grain and sort of, rather than these big flashy topics, oh, Lushenko did this, oh, Putin did that, oh, Trump did this, oh, Bezos did that. Is it more in the shockwaves of this explosion, in the wake of this tragedy, just figuring out a new language that's much more sort of simple in terms of what people need, that a lot of these conversations that are fun and theoretical to have, but if we are talking apocalypse, it's going to be, where can I get shelter? Where can I get food? Where can I get water? Is that something you're finding in your own language? I know you study theory and film very deeply, but is that something you're thinking about more of, like, all right, Jameson, that was fun, but like, this isn't very fucking useful in an apocalypse?
Yeah, to a certain extent, I feel like I've always had a part of me that was more like on the prepper side of things, and like not the apocalyptic version of it, or not at least not the neurotic and conspiracy theorist part of things, more on the just awareness. And I think that COVID-19 sort of just reemphasized this. One thing that people around me, including like people who live with me and other people who know me quite well, one thing that they have said recently is how well prepared I was for the pandemic. And what that actually means is I was just thinking of storing up some food before anything like that was being announced, like before January. It was just, it's a de facto thing that I do. And it's not, you know, I will cite Robert Evans here because he talked about this on his podcast as well, and he does it a bit better than I do. It's not that you are planning to fight off the zombies on your own, to use that story. It's more that you think you are aware that if you are better prepared, you can help the people around you as well. If you have just more of it, then you can use your, if you have a house, then you can use it to shelter people. If you don't have a house, that is more difficult to shelter people. If you have some money, that is easier to shelter people. If you don't have any, that's less easy. You know, the things that we used to consider, or at least that used to be imposed on us and that used to be seen as normal, these sort of social capital, for me, have just become more like immediate tools. Like, just to give you a very, very simple example, I have no savings right now with me. And part of it is because the money that I had made recently, I donated most of it. And this isn't a self-flagellating, whatever the expression is. It's just an awareness. It's you know that if less people around you are miserable, there's probably a better chance that you won't be miserable. If more people around you are just like dirt poor and miserable, and they have nothing to do with other than just find a way to survive, that's not a nice world to live in, you know, for you or for them, especially for them, obviously, but it's not very pretty for you either. So what are the options? The two options for me are either you end up being one of those, if you even have the financial capital to do it, and, you know, just live in those gated community and hope to God that you manage to wave off the zombies, or you find a way to just make it just not very, I don't know how to, I'm very bad with metaphors, I'm sorry, but like just not to make it that miserable around you. If your community, so basically building community resiliency is what I'm getting at. And for me, community resiliency can be like your literal community around you, which I'm very bad at doing because I'm very socially awkward and I don't have people skills. Or it could be a community across borders. So like you have your friends and who are across borders and whatnot, and you support one another this way. Part of the perks of globalization and so on, it's kind of like the financial transactions that you can do, like in the sense that like I can send my money, some money to my mom, if I need to, if she needs to. And part of the crisis in Lebanon was when that wasn't possible anymore. That was a big part of the crisis. And obviously, I think just the internet for me, it has become this tool of, do you need anything? Let me know what I can do, and if I need something, then there are a certain number of people as well who I can do this with, and it just becomes this thing. And this doesn't fix the world, you know. It's at least not at this scale. I think it needs to be significantly scaled up for that to make any difference. But those are spaces that are by definition anti-capitalistic, because I'm not drawing a profit. It's very bad for me money-wise. This is not the way to go about it if your goal was to just save up enough money to have your nice little house with a nice family and then put those kids in school. You know, that's not what I'm building towards. What I'm hoping to build towards, it's more that this sort of lifestyle, or not even this sort of security, think of it in a very, very basic way. This sort of security that I feel personally, when people think of the house and the family and the kids and the school, what they're actually kind of aspiring towards in some way is just a sense of security, just a sense of normalcy, just a sense of I don't have to wake up, I don't have to sleep terrified of what's going to happen tomorrow, that kind of thing. And I feel like we can build this in different formats on a community level. That doesn't have anything to do with what kind of degree you have, what kind of money you have, what kind of whatever you have, to the point where this becomes a de facto redistribution of wealth. I feel like for me, I genuinely believe that wealth should be redistributed. I feel like sometimes wealth should be abolished, but let's put that aside. Wealth should be redistributed, and it can be done in several ways. One way is higher taxes on the rich, and if that's an option, I'm just gonna say yes because I prefer this than the alternative. But another way is, or both together, building towards, I believe in diversity of tactics. I believe that we should do everything in our power, all of the tools in our power, to make the toxicity less toxic, to make the danger, the violent natures of the state less violent, and so on and so forth. That's my personal opinion. But you can do this in several ways. One of it, as I said, is through the state, which I don't think is very effective, and I think has its problem in the long term. And one thing is through community resiliency, which I think is actually more difficult to build, especially in the short term. But if when it sticks, it really does stick, and it can last for decades and decades after that. That's what I feel is something that we need to be better at doing, which some people are good at doing. Most people, I don't think, I'm not particularly very good at doing. It's something that I'm trying to work towards.
For Lebanese that you know, and for you yourself, what have your thoughts been about like ideology now that there is this void? Like, what have you held on to that you think still has pertinence? And what have you actually, post this tragedy, left behind and said, okay, this no longer applies?
For the most part, I think the main change in me in like the past decade or so, like I think you can start with 2011 with the uprisings and the revolutions in the region. And I started university around that time. I started university when it was starting to kick off in Tunisia and then in Egypt, literally like a month after. Sorry, a month before it kicked off. For me, the main changes is becoming like hyper pragmatic. Like I really think that part of my philosophy is alleviating suffering, however possible it is to do, however, like whatever the means are to just alleviate suffering. It doesn't mean that we don't take the means into account. It doesn't mean that the means are all equal. It doesn't mean that I think electoralism is gonna save us all. It doesn't mean anything really. It just means that. It means that if I have an option towards having a Biden or having a Trump, I will have the Biden because then it's someone I can fight rather than someone like Trump, which I feel 4 more years of him will put up, will just put our exist, like just the likelihood of existence on this planet even get significantly reduced. So for me, it's that kind of calculation that I make. So that's the more like pragmatic, some might say cynical. I don't think it is cynical. I actually think it's just realistic approach to things. But that's just part of the story. And for me, the difficulty is just trying to do you know, like I basically believe in a many modeled version of the world, if you see what I mean. I don't think there's one way of doing things. I think that indigenous philosophies and some, I don't know all of them, those that I have studied anyway, some of them function in where they are, others might not function in other places. And but that is in itself is an example of how they don't need to be integrated in everything else. Not everything has to be reduced to this, what we call global capitalism. And there are different ways of doing things. And I do genuinely believe that for the most part, if we have a certain diversity in that and on that front of different ways of doing things, that's probably for the better than having everything the same. That being said, I don't have any isms other than maybe feminism, I guess, would be the main thing that I still think is pertinent, although you know that can be abused obviously as well, and you can have white feminism and you can have middle class feminism and whatever, you can have like you know the Israeli Defense Forces feminism, you know you can have lots of different feminisms that aren't very feminist. Anarchism is sort of something I revolve around in the sense that like I might read a lot of anarchists, I might write for some anarchist publications, I talk to a lot of anarchists. I don't necessarily care about the term much. It's just for me a tool. You know, David Graeber talks about anarchism being kind of like a verb. I have some, you know, reservations on other stuff, but like for the, on that part, I agree with him. It's sort of that, and I just think that we need to be painfully aware of not just what we believe in, but when we are believing it and where are we believing it. I don't think that taking up arms is feasible in Lebanon. Taking up arms might be feasible in some parts of the US. Might, I don't know. I'm just saying it might. Taking up arms in some other parts of the world might just lead to immediate death, and it might not be a cost worth paying. I don't think these are all the same. I don't think the way to resist to Xi Jinping or the CCP is the same as resisting to you know, Bolsonaro. I don't think that defeating those agro businesses in the Amazon rainforest, I don't think this only happens by hoping that the native populations of the Amazon kick them out. I think this also has to happen at the source. It has to happen as to when, where are these countries that are making the demands for that kind of beef anyway? You know, as an example, what I'm trying to say is that there are multiple tools at our disposal that kind of shrivel away, like it's kind of death by a thousand cuts rather than just decapitation. I feel like the metaphor of decapitation, and we had this crime think article on like against the logic of the guillotine, which I've had him on, and we talked about this as well. And the logic isn't really that we don't want revenge. It's not that we don't want to make them pay. It's not that. It's just that we think that there are certain ways we can make them more irrelevant, which might be less satisfactory in the short term, but might actually prevent more of them from popping up in the future. And for me, that's my focus. I, in some ways, I feel that it's sort of, so I'm gonna say it in a way, but I'm not gonna mean it perfectly in that sense. But I don't think it's too late for me. But sometimes it feels like it's too late for me, in terms of Lebanon. If it feels that it's too late for our generation to really find a way to have a long-term solution. But whether that is true or not, I don't know. But what I know as a fact is that it shouldn't be true for those that are 14 and 15 today. It shouldn't be fair that if we had to deal with the warlords in our quote-unquote post-war era, that they also have to deal with them. So for me, I just have this intergenerational approach in some ways, but it goes back to the having just a money-modeled version of the world. I think it means nothing, and I'll end on that note. I think it doesn't mean anything for someone to say I am anti-capitalist. I think it doesn't mean anything for someone to say I am anti-Zionist. I think it doesn't mean anything for someone to say I am anti-globalization or whatever. For me, these are things that it depends where you're saying it and how you're saying it and what you're doing about it. You can say I'm anti-capitalistic, but then support Lukashenko. You know, he's supposedly anti-capitalistic, but that doesn't mean anything to me. Like, what are you replacing it with? And for me, it's the same in Lebanon. Some people think that Hezbollah isn't capitalistic. It is. But even if it wasn't, that doesn't mean that they're good. That doesn't mean that I want them there. That doesn't mean that I feel that their presence or their politics anyway, in Lebanon is good. for me, you know, you might call yourself anti-Zionist, but you may also be an anti-Semite. And for me, like, you know, I may be anti-Zionist, but if I'm sitting around with someone who calls himself an anti-Zionist and is also an anti-Semite, I don't want that person. You know, like, for me, those terms don't mean anything. They don't mean anything in themselves. That's why I try not to use them. I just try, other than feminism, maybe, I really try to just reduce these isms as much as possible and just focus on the concrete actions that are needed. So instead of saying I am an anti-capitalist, which, like, it's like 101, I've always been anti-capitalist. But instead of saying this, I say things like, we need to reduce our dependency on beef. I say things like, we need to reduce our dependency on oil. We need, you know, I say very concrete stuff that are, in my opinion, more useful in the long term, maybe more satisfying, less satisfying, that's for sure. But I just feel like just more useful. And I think we need to have a something that a worldview that prioritizes what is useful, what is most likely to reduce our damage to the environment, or even sometimes rehabilitate and rewild certain sections of the environment. What is more likely to just reduce suffering, reduce discrimination, make things less, more equitable, make things slightly less better, reduce the toxicity of our world. Because toxicity ends up having a language of its own and a raison d'être of its own. The more toxic some things become, the more difficult it is to get back from it. It's like when you have a war economy, after a certain period when the war starts, then you have a war economy that develops. And that is actually what sustains the war. Long, long, long after the ideologies that initiated the war, you know, have expired. That was the Lebanese Civil War. By the late 70s, no one really believed in anything. They started in 75, there was some kind of isms, and then they died out in the 70s, and then they continued for the entirety of the 80s anyway. That's what's happening in Syria now as well, to a different extent, but that's a different story.
So Lebanon has very diverse sort of security carceral systems, militias, warlords, sort of personal bodyguards that I don't really understand, of like a cult around like certain leaders. Do you have a sense of how they see Lebanon? And if you could offer, let's say, a utopia. So, like, I think why, like, Bourdain has had his ass handed to him a couple times when he goes to Lebanon is Lebanese will say to him, well, motherfucker, you don't live here. And, you know, he used to make sort of these comments of, oh, this is amazing, all these people living together. And people would sort of say that this is not a real utopia. We have all these issues. But if... Do you have a sense of why this carcerality after something, call it incompetence, call it murder, call it whatever you want to call it, just one of the most farcical tragedies in the country's history happens, and the security forces are right out there to defend the order that allowed this to happen? Do you have a sense of how they see Lebanon, and do you have sort of the antidote? To go back to your notion of potions, do you have the antidote to that, or is there an antidote to why they see the world that way, or Lebanon that way?
There's probably, again, like just like probably multiple antidotes. There's probably multiple ways of tackling that issue. So let's just call it the police question. In the case of Lebanon, as you mentioned, the police might be the easier thing to deal with. You have the army, you have the militias are the most difficult thing to deal with, because then you're not even part of the same environment in the first place. You're not paying the taxes, for example. You're not paying the taxes that are their salary, so you don't even have that direct connection in some way, even if symbolically. You have had some cases since October of like army soldiers temporarily refusing to do what they're asked to do, or at least sort of like postponing shooting at people so they would wait longer and whatever. And when by shooting, usually it's not direct fire. It's more like rubber bullets or tear gas or both. So you would have a bit of that. But then what gets through their days? I mean, it has to be, and I have had some conversations with members of the security forces, but not, I don't think representative enough to have a proper idea. But one thing that does definitely come up regularly is it's a combination of stability. So like they have some salary, even though it's not very good. They have some benefits. So like their family can have access to, you know, healthcare and that kind of stuff, cheaper education, you know, that kind of thing. And the other is a respectability. The army is still respected in Lebanon. It's actually the only thing that is respected, I think, for the most part. And that has even been dying out recently. Since the explosion, you have quite a lot of people being much more open about criticizing the army, like to the point where I was able to be more open, because before that I would be less willing, because then I would be one of the only persons to do it, and then the risk is just too high, the cost is just too high. Now it's a bit less, the cost is slightly less, in the sense that they're kind of being criticized from all over the place. And you have this chant, it's like, yeah, Askar, Askar Alamin. It's like, oh, army on what? It's like, who are you soldiering against? Kind of, it's a bad translation. Basically, like, what's your purpose? Like, who are you defending? You're defending those guys that are screwing you over as well. And so there's been a bit of that. It's probably the better method. I think it should probably be combined, as I said, with some kind of existing costs. Because let's put it this way, and this has happened. If you fight them back, then that creates a tension, that creates a space where you can actually talk to them and you can actually negotiate, and they could see that they are not respected. This is very important. If you don't fight back, so whenever the army comes, you just leave, which has happened quite a number of times, then their presence is validated, because then they can just tell themselves, well, clearly we are the better option, because what's the alternative? The alternative is Hezbollah. The alternative are the other militias. That's the alternative. And so, our presence is at least appreciated. We may not be loved, but we're tolerated. It's fine. People prefer us to the others, and that's good enough. Because, as I mentioned in the beginning, our expectations of anything in Lebanon is very low. This includes them. This includes our sense of self-worth. I think even our sense of self-worth, our sense of dignity, our sense of having no shame and all of that stuff. I think all of that's very, very low, and it's probably, or it's definitely, a kind of a consequence of having a war era regime in a post-war era. I feel like to tackle that question, part of it is going to happen organically, because I don't think they will manage to have their salaries paid at the same rate for too long. I don't even know. I think they're already being paid less right now, but I'm not sure. But more importantly, I think that they will have nothing to soldier on. There's just nothing left. They can beat up as many Syrian refugees as they want, but that doesn't seem to satisfy them enough. They still have to feel, at the end of the day, that some Lebanese, because obviously they don't give a shit what Syrians think of them, but some Lebanese still respect them. That's what they are morally invested in. If they are not, if that goes away, that makes it more difficult for them to recruit soldiers in the first place. That makes it more difficult for them to just believe in their own survivability. And that creates all sort of existential crisis, which in the case of Lebanon is very poignant, and it's very dangerous. If the army is just disbanded, we still have the others to worry about. That's the thing. It's not the only thing to worry about. If the police is abolished, which, in many areas you don't even have police. It's police in Lebanon is more like civil servants, usually like your neighbor. In my neighborhood, it's literally my neighbors who are the police. Like, I've known them since we were kids. That's what we mean by police. It's like more of a sheriff, old school kind of thing, but not in the modern sheriff sense of America. Anyway, I'm rambling a bit. It's kind of that, And so for the most part, they're not really a big deal, because they don't have much power. They may, like last time, I think we called the cops in our building, or my mom did, or my grandmother did, is because she was stuck in the house. Like, it's that kind of thing. And so that's why it's sort of like, I can say ACAB and I can say fuck the police and whatnot. For the most part, it won't resonate, because even if you get rid of them, then you still have to worry about the militias, you still have to worry about Hezbollah, the army, you have to worry about the bodyguards of these warlords, you have to worry about what are they called? The Parliament's Guards, that's what they're called, which are basically the private militias of Nabih Berri, the Speaker of Parliament. You will have all of these things to worry about as well. So you end up just finding a way to pick your battles, really, more than anything. So the answer to the COP question is probably a mixture of making sure through various ways, including some limited violence. By which I mean just fighting back. I don't necessarily mean that you literally go attack them, although some people are gonna opt that. option anyway, honestly, if things continue this way, but just enacting some kind of cost. And the other thing is a social cost, you know, physical cost, but the social cost as well. The financial cost, you don't have much to do about it. I think it's going to happen naturally anyway. What happens next, I don't really know. I don't really know if that would just kind of become a people's army or whatever. And even that will come, can have its risks, obviously. But we'll see, I guess. It's the future in Lebanon is as unpredictable as it ever was, if not more so right now.